For Gallup, I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we speak to Arthur Brooks about happiness, compassion, and partisanship amidst the global pandemic. Dr. Arthur C. Brooks is professor of the practice of public leadership at Harvard Kennedy School. Among many other titles and accolades, we at Gallup are also proud to call him a Gallup Senior Scientist. Arthur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you here. You're a social scientist that studies happiness and leadership in the context of social change. I want to start by asking you, how have you been informing and refining your thoughts on those issues as the coronavirus pandemic has been unfolding, both in terms of a health pandemic, but also in terms of the economic collapse that we're seeing globally?
Well, thanks for asking. And for actually, the first thing I was going to ask you is, how are you doing in your lockdown? Are you getting happier? Are you suffering?
I have a 7 and a 4-year-old, which I'll mention later. So it really depends on the hour you ask that question.
Yeah, I get it. You know, having little kids at home, and that's one of the big questions that people ask. I mean, having children, weirdly, you'd think that it's, you know, the major source of day-to-day happiness. It isn't. You find that the happiness of people tends to fall after they have their kids, but their meaning and significance and purpose in life rises. You know, with the coronavirus epidemic, everybody's dealing with different things for sure. But what I try to do as somebody, not just who studies happiness, but I try to make prescriptions. I mean, I have a podcast and a column that gives people advice on how to live better lives, is how to see difficulties that they're not anticipating in their lives as opportunities to become happier, to love more, to make moral and personal progress, and therefore to come out of difficult times better than they went in. And so that's my big goal right now, is to write and think and talk a lot about the things that people are suffering from and how they can turn those into advantages to make positive and permanent improvements in their life.
One of the things that's been really interesting through our data, just tracking how people are evaluating their lives, at least here in the U.S., is unlike a lot of times where we see life evaluation crumbling in certain societies across the world, a lot of it has really been a negative assessment of their current life, but hope for the future factor has still kind of held on. Is that consistent sort of with what you've been hearing and folks you've been engaging and thinking about?
Yeah, for sure. That's almost a truism, particularly when you look at the data on happiness among Americans. Americans are incredibly optimistic about how happy they're going to be in the future, which paradoxically brings a problem, Muhammad. I mean, it's a funny thing, but there's a guy named Hannes Schwant. He's a social scientist in Vienna. He's used our data, the Gallup data, in a lot of his work. And one of the things that he finds is that everybody, particularly Americans, think that 5 years from now, we're going to be happier than we are. And that's a problem for young adults. Because what happens is that they don't live up to their own expectations, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and brings their happiness down. But the good news is that by the time they get to their early 50s, by the time that they're, you know, I'm 56, so I'm scot-free. I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life. Because I don't think that. I don't think 5 years from now I'm going to be happier than now. And I get there and I am a little bit happier. That self-fulfilling prophecy actually brings me up. It's true, however, that by the way, the best gold standard data on happiness and most other topics like this comes from Gallup. Gallup has done miraculous work on actually doing the surveys around the world and in the United States to inform these things for social scientists like me, which is why I affiliated with Gallup. It's the best organization for that data. And I find that it is true that while people are, you know, uncomfortable right now, they know they're going to be okay.
Yeah. And it's, thank you for saying that. Of course, we are always happy and blessed to work with you and so many of our social scientists working on this topic. Some of you all attack it from the happiness angle. Some attack it from the well-being angle. It's really all the same subject. It's trying to put numbers to how people are living their lives beyond just GDP and counting numbers. Speaking of kind of the financial side, many of us probably listening are blessed to still have jobs. We can do our jobs on a computer. We have neighbors like my neighbor Sally, who's teaching my kids right now how to plant pumpkin seeds.
Nice.
We have all of these sources. The core sources of well-being are abundant in many of our lives. But for many Americans and many people across the world, whether it's poverty, unemployment, crime, you know, gentrification, rising living costs, the hollowing out the middle class in developed economies, all the things you really write about and speak on throughout your work, how, when you engage folks in those conditions, how do you tackle the topic of happiness? How do you kind of reach deep beyond, you know, what we tend to read in The Economist or other great sources on these data? How do you tackle those conversations?
Well, to begin with, as a public policy guy, I mean, I ran a think tank in DC for a long time, for 11 years,
AI,
a public policy think tank. Yeah, the American Enterprise Institute. And one of the things that you learn quickly when you do, when you specialize in the topic of happiness, is that all of the things that you just listed are not actually happiness related. They're unhappiness related. Now this is a non-trivial distinction, because people think that, absolutely, you know, light is the absence of darkness and unhappiness is the absence of happiness, but it's not. Happiness and unhappiness are processed in different hemispheres of the prefrontal cortex. And so you can actually see, using fMRI, that parts of the brain are illuminated when people have happy cognitions versus unhappy cognitions. And what this tells us is that you can be a very unhappy and a very happy person. It just means that you're a high affect person. You can also be low happiness and low unhappiness. And so what happens is that when politicians and policymakers, when they want to increase happiness, they keep running up against a wall. All governments can do now forever is they can lower the sources of unhappiness. The sources of happiness, they come from faith and family and friendship and meaningful work. The sources of unhappiness are manifold: traffic and pollution and insecurity about healthcare and jobs. All those things are only sources of unhappiness. So what public policymakers need to set themselves about doing is saying, how can I clear the most common sources of unhappiness out of the way cost effectively and without abridging the liberties that are important for people as well, such that people can pursue their happiness? That's the right agenda. I think the American founders had a pretty good bead on this. I just think that we often forget it.
Absolutely. And it's such a great segue to my next. You mentioned public policy. I have to bring in politics here. Toxic partisanship is something you've done some great work on and given some great speeches on. I remember, of course, your speech at the prayer breakfast, which I encourage everybody to Google if you haven't. It's absolutely fascinating example of somebody speaking their own truth to a situation where it's very unpopular to speak those words to that crowd. But obviously, you know, we have tons of data at Gallup that highlight, you know, the extreme partisanship we're living in. It goes back generations. We've beaten that to death. I want to ask you, though, do you see a path for American politics at the national level? And it's not as bad, really, at the local level. And we can talk about that. But at the national level, to overcome this hyper-partisan sort of paralysis in decision-making?
The answer is yes. And to just to motivate what you're talking about, it is absolutely true that polarization, hyper-partisanship and polarization are worse than they've been, and not worse than they've ever been. I mean, of course, we had a civil war in this country, and there were times in the 1850s that were objectively worse. But that said, it is at a particular high right now. And so people who think that it's bad, they're right. And the good news about that is that there are solutions, and the United States has been pretty good at getting out of this. You find typically, the best social science suggests that high levels of political polarization, they tend to occur in the 10 to 20 years after a major financial crisis. Now, financial crises are not ordinary recessions. I mean, we're in an extraordinary recession right now because we did it on purpose, but and we will come out of it. But ordinary recessions, we recover relatively quickly. Financial crises, they take a long time for people to feel like they're getting their piece of the pie. They take 10 to 15 years, sometimes 20 years, before there's an even distribution of wealth again. So the top 20% are not getting 80% of the returns to the economy. The result of that really long lag is that you get more polarization. You get more of this populism on the left and the right. And there's a lot of good studies that show that a financial crisis 10 years before has a 30% causal bump that it gives to populist parties and politicians. It's really what we're seeing by the numbers. But the good news is that it wears off. You know, that populism that we're seeing that leads to polarization and the hyperpartisanship is not the status quo. We always have some of it. We remember the past is better than it was. I mean, the truth is that you know, we think of Franklin Roosevelt as, you know, presiding over a time where everybody wanted the, that, you know, people were really behind him. He's winning landslide elections, but you know, he was so despised, and he was so bitter about his enemies that he gave one very famous speech in which he listed the people that hated him, and he said, "I welcome their hate." I mean, you know, and this is FDR, man. I mean, so there's nothing new under the sun. So yeah, to begin with, yeah, things weren't as good ever as we thought, and things will be better than they are now. This we know as well. And the way that happens is that politics, which we say, you know, Tip O'Neill, you famously said that all politics is local. Local politics is downstream from, or I should say upstream from federal politics, from national politics. That's kind of what we're going to see. We're going to see, you know, pull a governor out of the hat, Doug Ducey from Arizona. It's one of my great favorites. He's a very, very partisan Republican, but he fights for everybody. Or my governor, Charlie Baker, here in Massachusetts, is the most popular governor in America, 70% approval. He's a Republican in the bluest state. You also have, you know, Democrats who are popular in more or less red states. And, you know, that's what we see right now. And that's resolving. You're going to see politicians who have this big new entrepreneurial idea of not being a jerk. And, you know, at sometime in the coming years, it's like, wow, this is incredible. It's visionary. Just being a decent person. I know. And, you know, so that's going to become a brand in the next 5 years is what I predict.
That's absolutely a perfect segue for my next question, which is not really a question. It's just a fact I want you to comment on. 6 in 10 Americans say that the political system in their country doesn't make them proud to be an American. Reflect on that for us.
Where'd you get those data, Mohammed? That's crazy.
I saw them somewhere on Twitter. No, those are actually from our summer. We'll be updating those in July, by the way. But it's a fascinating list where a lot of things like pluralism, opportunity, science and technology are all in that kind of 90-80% range of things, of the number of people who say that makes me proud to be an American.
Yeah.
The political system comes in really low.
Yeah. How does it compare? Here's the question that I have. How does it compare with, and let's say that, I don't know, the mid 90s or, you know, let's say the year 2003. How does it compare? These are periods in which we had relative political stability. We had differences.
Yes.
Relative political stability. Were a majority of people then saying that the political system in America made them proud to be Americans, or was it?
So we didn't have the exact same question wording, but there are things that have really declined. So, for example, we asked, like, how much confidence do you have in the honesty and transparency of the media that you have access to in the United States? In Nixon's impeachment time, it was around 7 in 10 Americans said they had confidence in the media.
Right.
Today, it's 4 in 10. Mm-hmm. So on these institutional pieces, and we've seen, you know, trust in institutions, whether all three branches of government, et cetera, have declined a little bit.
Right.
But we have seen a change in attitude on some of those, maybe not institutions as in a brick and mortar building, but things like the media, things like capitalism, which I know you write about a lot and think about, their brand has tarnished a little bit with a segment of American society, not everyone. You know, one of the big misnomers out there is that socialism is suddenly very popular. That's not actually very true beyond a part of the Democratic Party.
The
data, what's interesting is that the brand of capitalism has actually declined among younger folks and, of course, among folks that are on the far left of the spectrum.
Yeah,
but I'm yapping too much. I want you to comment on
this. Good. This is all really good. Yeah, 6 in 10 Americans say that their political system doesn't make them proud to be an American. Now, there are two things that are going on here. Number one is that politics is pretty chronically unpopular. I mean, people don't like politics. And, you know, I want to live in a country where people don't really like politics very much. Now, people are addicted to it. They get this big dopamine hit by looking at their, you know, their favorite politically hateful columnist or TV network of, you know, their political choice, but they don't actually like politics very much. And it's kind of, it's fashionable to talk bad about politics, right? To say, I don't like my politicians, et cetera, et cetera.
There's nothing more American than not trusting the federal government.
Yeah, that's right. Most people, by the way, like and trust their own congressmen, but they don't like or trust Congress, which is another thing that we found with the Gallup data forever.
Fascinating. Right?
It seems like a paradox. It's kind of like, I love my kid's teacher, but I don't like the teacher's union. Well, you know, that's a scaling issue. That's a composition issue that we see. That's number one. Number two is that there has been, so that's a sort of a truism throughout time. The second thing, however, is that we've seen a diminution in the trust that we have for institutions in this country. And this is a lot more alarming. I'm not very worried if people say, politicians, blah. But I am kind of worried if all the major institutions are attenuating with respect to the confidence that people have in them, because that's really, really bad for our society. Now, what we find is that people lose confidence in institutions when institutions are perceived as being more partisan. So you're going to say, I want my news network to support my candidate. Yeah. But you're also paradoxically going to trust that news network less, even the one with which you agree.
Fascinating.
And when isn't it interesting? And so basically this is, and the press has become more partisan. And members of the press have become more overtly partisan. And part of the reason that we know that is because individual journalists who are really, really good journalists are on social media giving their true views. And so you can say, okay, it's shocking how much they're ruining their brand and hurting their careers. They don't think, I mean, it's basically their name recognition is going to rise, but people literally trust them less, including their fans. It's like, I love that guy. He says all the things that I think. Do you trust him? You know, I want somebody who calls balls and strikes for trust,
yeah.
Not for entertainment. You know, for entertainment, I want somebody to tell me I'm right. For trust, I want somebody who's not going to tell me necessarily that I'm right, but who's going to call him like he sees him. So that's this kind of paradox that we've got in here. And I think that we have a big crisis of institutions and a crisis of confidence in these institutions as well. Some actually have been, there's one institution, and I'll quiz you on this. This is our data, because I'm a senior scientist. Our data show that there's one institution, public sector institution, that for 30 years has consistently risen in the trust that the American people give it. You know which one it is?
My guess would be, I might have to call a friend, but the U.S. military.
Exactly right. Well done, sir. Well All done. Right. That is exactly right. The U.S. military has consistently risen in the esteem that people have for it and the trust that people have for it. Coming out of the, you know, in the after the Vietnam War, the trust of the American military was very low, but it has risen, and it's just year after year after year after year.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, despite the fact that the Iraq War over that same period of time became very unpopular. But that didn't reflect negatively upon people's assessment of the military.
No, okay. It's amazing. I want to
ask you and kind of close out on a conceptual point here. Last week, we had Ian Bremmer on the show, and he basically declared American exceptionalism as sort of a myth. I know you have a different take on the subject. Tell us about how you view the concept, first of all. But I also want you to get into whether the view has been at all changed by the crisis on COVID and the response to it here in the U.S. and how the world has kind of watched that unfold.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a complicated one for sure. You know, we could write books about this, and thankfully for the world, I won't. The state of American exceptionalism, first in general, and then with respect to COVID, how COVID has changed it. So first, let me ask you a question. When did the Unises come here?
1981.
From where?
From Cairo, Egypt. And we came because my mom had a scholarship to do a PhD in physical therapy.
Are your parents still alive?
They are, and they are both still physical therapists, and they live in Southern California.
Yeah, yeah. And I bet you that they're really glad they're here, right?
Oh, man, my parents are, you know, talk about American exceptionalism. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It was interesting to me, Arthur, in 9/11, I was like, I was 19. And seeing my dad reflect on how Americans, and I know all, obviously in the media, and there was a huge rise in hate crimes. There were a lot of tragic things going on.
Yeah.
But watching how my dad kind of processed how every non-Muslim we knew in our lives basically reached out to us to see if we were okay, to express solidarity, and how moved he was by that. It was interesting to me to see, you know, it wasn't crazy that American exceptionalism would be something that two immigrants from Cairo that came here and made it and see their kids having wonderful lives and grandkids believe in. The reality, though, is if you came here when they came here, that's a really easy story to believe in. If most of your adult experience has been post-2008, where the economy has been operating very differently in the United States, you have a different worldview.
You do, except you still find that the rates of application for immigration in the United States have continued to rise. You don't, I mean, look, nobody wants to get into China. You know, nobody wants to get into most other places in the world, and most other places in the world, including other advanced democratic nations, are second choice to the United States. Look, people vote with their feet. It's real easy for those of us who were born in the United States to say American exceptionalism is dead. Ask an immigrant.
Yeah.
Ask an aspiring immigrant. I mean, for
we
me,
we do all I over mean, the world, and the data show yeah, the U.S. is always number one.
Yeah, and you know, it's like even people who are really critical of the United States in countries, you know, so I guess, you know, last time I looked at our data on views about the United States, you find that the number one country where people are critical of the United States, I think, is Pakistan, right? Isn't that where we find a lot of really, you know, critical views about the United States or unfavorable views, right?
We do. In the countries who are impacted the most by acute conflicts involving U.S. foreign policy tend to have the most negative views of the United States. Absolutely.
That's right. But at the same time, from those very same countries, we see long lines of people that are trying to get into the United States. And so and people will take it, like they'll look at these public opinion polls and say, well, hey, man, the Egyptians, they don't love the United States. So it turns out the Egyptians are actually pretty pro-American. But you get my point.
Yeah.
Right. They still, you know, people still want to get in. And those are two different phenomena, is a judgment about American foreign policy from afar and the desire to build your life in the United States. If you believe the United States will give you the system where you can build your life, where you can earn your success, where you, through your hard work and personal responsibility, that you can rise, not perfectly, nobody thinks it's perfect, but where you can do it better than where you are, that is prima facie evidence of continuing American exceptionalism. And I'm just making a pure, you know, survey data-based, market-based explanation for it, because, you know, it's like I'm a social scientist, not an ideologue as far as this is concerned. Now, so in other words, you know, and again, I'm married to an immigrant, and you know, it's classic, right? I mean, I know tons of people in my wife's home country, which is Spain. It's like, oh, United States, imperialistic, you know, capitalistic.
You want to send your kids to go to college there?
It's like, and they're yes. Like, yes, 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 yes. Why? Land of opportunity. That is exceptionalism in a nutshell. Okay. COVID. COVID has not reflected very well on most countries. You can say that certain countries have done better with respect to containing the virus. You know, we look and we sort of admire what's happened, certainly in Taiwan, certainly in Korea. But those, of course, are Asian countries that where their economies and political systems were built on the democratic capitalist model that was propagated by the United States with the United States support and help and military assistance.
Yep.
That's the truth. And the country where the coronavirus started, which is China, and which actually had a lot of the sociopolitical or the politico-economic problems that followed from it, is a different model. Now, here's the real question with respect to American exceptionalism. Ask anybody around the world and say, who did a better job containing it? You can have all sorts of different differences of opinion. Fine. Where is the solution going to come from? Nobody thinks, well, yeah, I think that the Chinese are going to come up with a vaccine. Nobody thinks that.
Wow.
It's going to come from the United States and countries that are affiliated with the United States that have the democratic, capitalist, economic, and political model. Exceptionalism is our ability through hard work and personal responsibility to rise, to earn our success, and to serve each other. Are we perfect? Uh-uh. There's a ton of things that drive me crazy about this country that I think that other countries do better than we do. I mean, let's just be honest here, right? But at the same time, I mean, this place is amazing. And in the coronavirus epidemic, we're going to look back on it and say, I'm really, really glad that it was the democratic capitalist system that made it possible for a virus that come along, that nip that thing in the bud, that let us get back to our normal lives.
Wow. That's Arthur Brooks, Gallup senior scientist and professor of the practice at Harvard Kennedy School. Make sure to check out Arthur's podcast, Ricochet, to catch more of his thoughts. Arthur, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Mohammed. It's great to be with you. I hope you have a great day.
That's our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions, feedback, or suggestions on topics for future episodes, we want to hear from you. Write to us directly by emailing podcast@gallup.com. This Gallup podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.